the gal. Just like the gal that married dear old Fred. What a chick. Mind, George, if I work it right, I'll get the gal that married. Ever had. It's depressing to note that the truth is beginning to sneak out, and if there's anything that can kill you quicker, it's the truth. For centuries, mankind has been hiding the truth under all available rocks, not to mention under the bed. And that's why people are always afraid to look under the bed. There's a pair of leering green eyes looking out, and it's that rotten, crummy truth. I'll never forget the time Ransom Sherman, who used to be on the radio, lo, these many centuries ago, had a contest to name the product that is found under the bed. You know, when you sweep under the bed, those little round things that come out, you know, those little fuzzy things. He had a nationwide contest to name them. They would never think of that today on the radio or on the television or anything else. Everyone likes to pretend that in the modern homes created by Better Homes and Gardens, you know, out at the World's Fair, there's the House of Good Taste, and you ought to see it, oi. Do you know what they finally named those things under the bed? You know what they finally did? They had a nationwide contest to name them, and they had over 48 million replies on it because everybody... And they finally named them, and you know, believe it or not, it's one of the rare times when something was named on a radio show that the name stuck. People still use that name. What? Well, if you don't know, then you're not worthy of looking under the bed. You know, speaking of the truth, here's a little thing here from the Home Furnishings Daily, a simple statement of fact, April 1964 issue, and there's a full-page ad, and all it says simply in black type, happiness is finding that consumers are all alike. Happiness is finding that consumers are all alike. Suckers, everyone. Hello, consumer. You cease to be a citizen, you know, or a person, or an individual. You are now a consumer, a great user of goods, a devourer of material, a driver of machines. Oh, yes, you want to hear. Oh, here, speaking of ads, the ad, truth is beating your mind. Listen to this beautiful one. Do you have give me my spooky music there, please. From nothing on your back there. Guaranteed authentic facsimile. Famous military medals for sale. These handsome crafted medals of honor are perfect replicas, slightly reduced in size, of the world's famous medals awarded only to the bravest of the brave for various deeds above and beyond the call of duty. Each medal is approximately 2 1/4 by 1 inch, including authentic ribbon and pin, and comes mounted on a full-color presentation card that gives the history of the medal and why awarded. Makes a wonderful collection, can be awarded to youngsters by parents for deeds at home or excellent marks at school. A perfect gift idea includes the Iron Cross of Germany, Pour le Mérite, first class. And now, for getting a B+ in spelling, Charles, we award you the Iron Cross, first class. And you, Fred, for getting a C- in biology, we award you the Croix de Gras, the first order of the Cross Sabers of the King of Belgium. And Luigi, little Luigi, for you getting C- in arithmetic, we award you the Order of the Crown, second class, Umberto, Italy. We guarantee immediate delivery, and satisfaction is also guaranteed. da, da, da. You remember when they used to just give little gold stars for, you know, doing something in spelling? A little gold star. Somehow there is a little kind of a... I don't know, there's an eerie thought to this, giving kids the Iron Cross. No, I'm reading to you an ad. I did not invent this. For those of you who wonder where the devil this came from the silly page in the New York Times. And the silly page can be found every Sunday. It's that page in the back there where they sell the giant rose bush trees, you know, and the place where you can get the things where you stamp your name on your Bermuda shorts, and you get the telescope and the hearing aid where you can hear your neighbor's conversation, the silly page there. And you'll find that these medals are for sale. And for those of you who've been wondering for the perfect gift for your kid because he did it in spelling, there it is, the Iron Cross. That's a very attractive medal, by the way. It actually is. It's one of the most, one of the most singularly... yes, it is. It's a very impressive medal. I remember pictures of Rommel, you know, with it hanging up there by the neck there, just down there with the big goggles over. And I'm sure that before the next 2 years are out, kids, you know how kids buy little soldier suits? I'm sure that little kids will be able to buy a Hauptmann uniform. That is in the SS, of course, which is a very spectacular uniform. I don't know whether you've ever seen that. You know, it's a very colorful uniform. With the skulls, you know, on the lapels there. Yeah, they had the skulls. It was very interesting. It's very interesting. That's much more important. In a way, there's a little more pizzazz there than just being just a corporal in the U.S. Signal Corps. And, that's one thing I've always noticed about the American Army. It is very uncolorful. It has none of the pizzazz that many other armies have. For example, the equivalent rank to the rank that I once held in the U.S. Army briefly. I was busted up and down four times and finally got up. At one point in my career, I held a rank that was, it was called the T5. This is a T5. I mean, it's a very dull rank, T5. And the equivalent rank in the German Army was Lance Corporal. I mean, Lance Corporal. Somehow there would be something, the idea of being a Lance Corporal, a T5, I mean, technician fifth grade. way down the line in the signal outfit. You know, speaking of the truth, is beginning to creep on. I don't know whether any of you saw a television guide. This is a current, it's a Rosetta Stone of our time in a way. But only occasionally does television ever really talk about what it's really all about, Al. And look at this ad in the television guide for this week. It says, the most exciting thing on TV tonight will be a commercial. Whoa! That cheap microphone here. All right, cut it there, hold it. The most exciting thing on TV tonight will be a commercial. Now, it's very rare that television admits that about itself. And in TV Guide at that, I wonder how many people in the television industry recognize that this is often quite the case. They have found, through long, arduous studies, believe it or not, they have found today that span, or not even a span, let's say the density of attention, you know, they're beginning to make a differentiation between a guy just sitting there with his mouth hanging open slackly, with the saliva dribbling down over his shirt, sitting there watching television. They're making a differentiation now between that guy and a guy who's sitting there with his eyeballs bugged out, tensely watching. Yes, so they're not the same guy, and they have now what they call an attention density scale in television rating systems. Did you know that? And it's very hard to tell, especially when people's hair is up in curlers and that, what their attention, how their density is going. But nevertheless, they have been able to work out a very rough scale. And in a few years, they figure it'll be all smoothed out and they'll be able to tell, really, you see. But now they are beginning to find, which is a very scary thing, that the attention density goes up the instant the commercials come on. which is exactly the opposite of what most people used to think. Oh, yeah, do you know that, I'll tell you one of the funny things that I have begun to realize in this business, that the people complain about commercials. You know, it's a ritualistic complaint, though. It has no basis in reality. It's just like people, oh, boy, it's raining. You know, they complain about the weather, but it's not a real complaint. People accept the weather as, you know, the earth and the sand. It is there. It's ritualistic. And by ritualism, you know how people, when they'll get on an elevator or something, and they'll say, well, how are you, Charlie? And you're not even listening. You don't give a darn how Charlie is, you know. All right, Charlie. And he's up there, he's running the machine. He says, it's okay. I'm pretty good. How are you? This is a ritual. This is literally a ritual that is as complete a ritual as any kind of religious ritual is. Now, the commercial complaining, the complaining that people do about commercials is a ritual in our time. And, hey, what's the trouble in there? Are we having troubles in there, fellas? Hey, hello, test, okay? All right, fine. That the problem of ritual in commercial is this, that people complain about commercials, right? You complain about them. Now, I'm going to tell you something that might surprise you, that out of every 150 letters I get, there will be 10 or 15 to 20 letters that will tell me that the reason that I am not commercial, that I am not sponsored, the reason that I do not have commercials is because I'm a rotten no-goodnik. Now, the point, what's the trouble in there? You guys are confusing the hell out of me. What? Huh? Boobing. I can't understand you. You mean there's a band playing somewhere? Well, that's all right. Let it play. Don't quit worrying. Let's do our show here. Let's let the band play in the next studio. As long as it's not coming on the tape, we're okay. Well, even if it is, it's okay. Our show works fine with music, sandblasters. Let's just get it done here. Now, all right, fellas. All right. Gee whiz. all right. All calm down in there for a while. Well, all right, now while I'm making the station break, we'll give you 1 minute to run around. Get it all out of your system. You can run around, look out of the windows, and scratch the walls and everything in there. Okay, fellas? All right. No, go ahead, take advantage of it. I'm giving you time to run around in there. Now you don't care, I see. As soon as I start, you'll start running around now. And see what happens with the ritual. Speaking of rituals, this is WOR AM at FM New York, and we'll be here for a while, for crying out loud. I'm really interested in this commercial thing because it says a lot about something in our society. This thing of the density towards commercials. And I can tell you this, that the most popular, and if I say popular, I get the most mail, the most popular shows I ever do on this time slot is when I talk about commercials. I can talk about the decay of our morality, nothing, get no mail. I can talk about the fact that the Earth has been moved 7 degrees off its axis and is now heading towards Saturn at 18 million miles an hour, nothing. I can tell you that tomorrow morning, Cleveland will be destroyed by a barrage of rockets carrying nothing. But all I've got to do is talk about the Ford commercials or Mr. Clean, and I am deluged with applauding mail, which makes me realize what we're really interested in. Even if we're mad at them, we're interested in them. Now, we're not really mad. That's the point I'm making here. That most people feel secure when they're listening to something today if it has a commercial on it. In short, the programs that do not have commercials in them do not seem real programs to you. And since they don't seem real programs, their validity is lessened by that much. Great. No commercials means no good program. Now, I think this is also related to the fact that if you go down to a Broadway show and you go to a show and if you can just walk up and buy a ticket to that show, just walk right up to the box office now. You say the show starts at 8:40 and you can walk up at 8:15 and buy a ticket, you think it's a lousy show. And it's a fact. And if you have to wait 2.5 months to buy a ticket to a show, it therefore begins to assume an importance that you don't even see on the stage 9 times out of 10. And even if you wait 2.5 months, you get the ticket, you go see it, you will be convinced it's good. You literally will. You'll sit there and you'll just be gassed by everything that happens up there. Even if it's lousy, even if you've seen it 1,000 times before, somehow it seems great. And I find that the mail that I get on a show, it tips this off in a way. I've had intelligent people write to me. I mean, they'll write a very intelligent, involved, learned dissertation on French literature, the first half of their letter. And then they'll go into a thing where they will say, well, of course, it is quite obvious, since you are an ignorant slob, that is why you do not have the whoopee commercials on your show. And by George, the point being that they even themselves, even the guy who was the intellectual anti-commercial, recognizes the commercial as an official thing in our society. And it's official to him. He recognizes that if it's before and after commercial, then it is regular and official. Now, have you noticed the Lincoln Center, for example? That's a great example of it. That 90% of the stuff that I have seen at the Lincoln Center, if it were done in a loft somewhere, would be booted right out of the such a collection of farina as you've never seen in your life being down over there at the Lincoln Center. And yet, because it's in a great big, very expensive building, and it is in a very expensive setting, it becomes a very official, great production. Everyone sort of approaches it as if they're approaching some sort of a giant ritualistic achievement, and has nothing whatsoever to do with what's seen on the stage. This is all part of that ritual thing. Price and money, the payment, I think is more important today than the actuality of what you get. Now, this has not always been the case. It has not, certainly not always been the case. I used to sell cars. I'll tell you a little secret thing about that. And one time, Al, you might find this interesting. You would expect that people would consider a car as a car as a car. In other words, if you buy a Chevy from Charlie or if you buy a Chevy from Fred, you're getting the same car. It all comes out of the same factory. It's the same model. It's the same make and everything else. You would expect then that the people would approach it as an object rather than as an abstraction. Well, let me tell you what happened. We were selling out our car business, the people that I was involved with, all of us. We decided that we were going to go into another thing. We were going to sell out our car business, and we had a half dozen famous automobiles in stock. The cars happened to be, at that time, Austin Healey's. They're recognized automobiles, you see. We had about a half dozen of them in stock, and so we decided that since our lease was up in 1 month, we had to get rid of them in a hurry. And so we put 6 of them on the floor, and we're selling them at cost, absolute cost, complete with the warranty, everything, brand new cars. We're selling them at cost. People would wander in and look at them with a kind of a funny look on their face, and they'd look at them, they'd walk around, and they'd get in, and here was a brand new Austin Healey, you see. They'd look at it. We were a recognized dealer, the whole scene. They'd walk around. And by George, they would walk right down the street to the other dealer who was selling them at the regular price and buy them. We could not understand it. And we kept this up for about a week, you see. And then one day, one of the partners says, oh, for crying out loud. With that, we put up the price, you know. We tacked it right back up to 3 G's. We put a big sign on it, says we've just added another $100 to the price because they're so much in demand. And believe it or not, within 3 days, we had sold all 6 of them. We could not move a one for a whole week at cost. Now, that sounds to you like a fairy tale. I'm going to tell you, it actually is the truth. So I wonder how much the ritual involves. And so this little note in TV Guide that says the most exciting thing on TV tonight will be a commercial. Has it ever been otherwise? Has it ever been? I'll guarantee you, you remember the old Kraft Theater? Well, I'll guarantee you, very few of you can remember anything you ever saw on the Kraft Theater except those Kraft cheese commercials, where the guy would say, and now pour the melted cheese over the frizzled toast. Wait for just a moment, and now add a touch of paprika and just a little salt and pepper, and it serves 6. You remember those crap commercials? Immediately you all say, yeah, I remember those commercials. Or I try to remember what went on between those commercials. Farina and A Yard Wide, you don't remember it at all. But you sure remember those cheese sandwiches. And it's an intriguing thing that most people can remember a Geritol commercial with the tired blood far longer than they can remember the guy who played the terrible accordion just before the Geritol commercial. It is the truth. It is a fact. And yet we claim we're against commercials. Are you really against commercials? Well, let me tell you this. The New York World's Fair is one giant commercial, Dad. And you will go and you will love it. Because I have been at the fair, and I know that it is one enormous, fantastic, unbelievably giant commercial. And the bigger the commercial, the more you'll love it. And it's interesting to note how many people are rushing past the non-commercial stuff at the fair. You know, like there'll be a long involved mural or a panel depicting the evolution of the movable type. Or the evolution of literature in the Western world. Everybody's running past that, and they are getting on the giant GM Futurama drive or something to sit in the front seat of a new Pontiac. And it is a fact. It is just a truth. And even though we don't want to admit it, it is a moving thing in our time. You know, speaking of misconceptions that we have, one of them I think is the commercial misconception. There was a great cartoon in Punch, and it's not often that a cartoon... Of course, I think in many ways one single cartoon can say more than 45 editorials. And here are two guys, two Englishmen, standing in front of a fantastic machine. This machine is just giant. It has little arrows, and it has oscilloscope screens and the whole scene all over it. Giant machine. And these two guys are looking at it, and one guy is saying to the other guy, "True, but I dare say you and I are only as good as the data fed into us." Well, now there's the old canard that people have about machines, that it's only as good as the data that's fed into it, implying that man is better than the data that's fed into him. Well, this is going to come to as a complete surprise to many psychologists, who will tell you that man literally is even worse than a machine in the sense of being only as good as the data that's fed into him. Entire populations have been caused to do things that no machine could ever do. A great example is the rise of Nazi Germany, talking about that. They're only as good as the data fed into them. And after about 15 years of the right data, man will do anything. He'll literally do anything. And what we call data, of course, is a varying thing. It isn't necessarily just a tape. It isn't necessarily just a record that's played, anything like that. What kind of data has been fed into you? Now, really seriously, what kind of data are you the product of? Well, I'm often concerned about that in my own case. I find that there are varying attitudes. Say, for example, the attitude that you might have towards, your society, the strata of society that you are from. Now, I'm sure that if I were to talk about baseball to you, there would be a large number of people automatically would turn away from the radio set immediately, because the data that's been fed into them in their strata of society over probably their lifespan has said that baseball is a slob and a completely nonsensical activity. Stay away. Tune away immediately. Tune away. Tune away. Tune away. This is a data. This is literally just like a little IBM card that is inserted in a machine, and the instant something is brought up, your little card flips into place. Baseball, and the little card goes tum 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 tum, and the little punched holes will not allow anything to come through other than slob, slob, slob. Now, if I were to say to you, the American theater, well, I'm sure that there is a large number of you out there. There are a tremendous group of people out there who, because they have been brought up in a certain kind of society, believe that the theater is of immense importance. It says immensely important things about us. Have you ever noticed in the New York Times the serious letters that people write, my life ever expanding, ever upward and onward, due to the work of Arthur Miller, blah, 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 blah. Yes, and it's always signed something like Dr. So-and-so in Rosedale, New York. He really gets a great insight through watching, say, After the Fall or any of these things. Now, I question whether he really does, or whether, because of the data that he's been fed over his life, his little machine says that he does. Now, these are not such easily answered questions. They're really not. Now, the assumption, of course, is always made that more reading leads to greater insight. This is another society. Another group of society believes that the number of that you can measure a man by the number of books he owns. Well, all right, the little IBM card's automatic when I say books. Let's talk about books tonight. I mean, did he ever, oh, well, now he's at least making sense. Oh, boy, now he's going to talk about something great. Dum, 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 little card slip into place. Well, now I can be talking about something called the miraculous, you know, I can be talk. Really, I can talk about things like the giant train robbery. It doesn't make any difference. Somehow, a book has a tremendous importance to large numbers of people. Now, have you noticed, even though the books can be sheer dross and a yard wide, they become important. Now here, let's take an example of that. James Bond writes pure junk. This is pure, unadulterated junk. And large numbers of people who are in the intellectual community love it. Now, if that same junk were done in the comic strips, they would not look at it. Now, that's why do they look at it in one area and they won't look at it in another? Well, it's because of the little IBM card that says book. It goes, and somehow if it's in a book, even if it's junk, they will chuckle but read it. If you say, here, look at this comic strip, Fred. It's a wild comic strip about this guy named 007. And look at, he's blowing up the trains. Look at that. He's killing the girl. Look at that. He's stabbing her. They all, come on, comic strips. And they shove it aside. Now, what? Why? Well, nobody quite knows why. These are all the various little ritualistic things in any given society. Now there is another group of people who really are so completely involved, and this is a growing thing today, that are so completely involved in the movies, although those people, the hipper you are, the less you're inclined to call it movies. You call it flicks. You may call it the cinema. You may call it the pictures. The one thing you stay away from is to use the term movie, because somehow movie is related with Doris Day. Movies are related with Charlton Heston. If you call them flicks, it's related to Flaming Creatures. you know, if you call them, yeah, really, if you call it the cinema, it's related to somehow Alec Guinness. Now, these words are very important. They really are. The ritualistic thing that a word plays in our mind. If some guy, I'm going to go to the movies tonight, he's a slob. This is a guy, you know, obviously he's going to go down and see Charlton Heston or something. But if he says, I'm going to the flicks tonight, this is a certain hipness. It shows that he is going down, and he's taking the movies with a pseudo-carelessness, but very serious. Anyone who says flick is giving you a surface example. He's giving you a surface casual, but he's very serious about it. Very, very serious. This is a very important thing to him. So don't be fooled by the words. They're very, very, and don't be fooled by the fact, you see, and of course we will make differentiations now. The sex as portrayed by, let's say, somebody like Doris Day is always put down by the flick or the cinema people. The sex that's displayed by Brigitte Bardot is art. This is art. and yet, anyone can tell you, with even a modicum of psychological training, that it's all libido and a yard wide. Don't be fooled, because it's Melina McCrory. Somehow it's much more important. The fluttering of the eyelashes and the heavy breathing somehow has more validity than the fluttering of the eyelashes and the heavy breathing of, let's say, Audrey Hepburn. Well, because one is a movie and the other is a flick. One is shot in Hollywood, the other is shot in Greece, and that makes a big difference. Well, this is all ritualistic, very important. Have you noticed that the serious people go to see the Beatles? Well, it's English. It couldn't possibly have happened if these four guys came out of Cleveland. They, I want to hold your hand, yeah, yeah. They wouldn't, they wouldn't go. How many of the serious people ever went to see the Four Freshmen or Bull Moose Jackson, or the Four Whoopies? It doesn't matter, but it's all ritualistic. Again, this is very important. It has to be seen that it has a lot to do with the frame in which it is seen. You just can't put it down. I've seen this work in so many areas. Now let's take another one. Let's take the entire area of politics. Now, this—if I were to say to you, like, again, this is how good are you with the data that's fed into you? If I say to you, liberal, well, now, if you come from a certain familial background, a certain background of a certain society, the word liberal means good, automatically good. If I were to say to you, conservative, that automatically means bad. You don't even have to say any more. You don't even have to discuss what the conservative has said or what the liberal has said. It is not a matter of discussion. It is a matter of a little card slipping into place. Okay, you follow that? Now, on the other hand, if you come from the opposite kind of society, and if I say liberal, automatically that means communist dupe. It means soft hogwash. It means a person who is a bleeding heart. You can go on and name all these. In short, bad. That's a bad guy. Conservative is a good, solid, practical man who knows, who really has his feet on the ground and who takes no guff. He understands reality, and by George, he lives on it. And he's not a sentimentalist. He's a good man. So it depends on what side you're from. And for that reason, a really shrewd practitioner uses these terms. He uses these terms, and so you can promote the wildest, most reactionary, conservative things if you call yourself a liberal, and many liberals will buy it merely because the right word is used. And on the other hand, if you are a conservative, you can really promote doing away with the Constitution, literally. Many conservatives have actually done this. They will advocate doing away with the Constitution, which is the most radical of all moves in this society. And as long as you say you're conservative, then that will be applauded. So this also follows in the theater. If you're going to do a play and you want it to be considered a serious play, do it off-Broadway. Do it off-Broadway. This will be considered serious theater now, today, in our time. It could be the world's worst lousy little musical, but it's a serious attempt to do something. It's very serious. Now, if you want to be considered part of the theater, the real theater, you must do it on Broadway. You just have to do whatever you do on Broadway, because Broadway is where the theater happens. Now, there's two little subdivisions there. One is serious, the other is the theater, showbiz, Tallulah Bankhead. You know, all this. It's all the wonderful myth of the theater. Jason Robards, the whole Richard Rogers, William Inge, it's all that. Now, is that serious theater? That's theater. And you'll hear hour after hour of talk on the air about the theater, and rarely do I ever hear one of these actors or actresses being interviewed by one of the interviewers say what this playwright actually said about life. They hardly ever can tell you, and it doesn't really matter. It's theater, and I think the theater is so darling, so delightful. There's nothing actually the life in the theater that I come from a theatrical family, you know. And I'll never forget the first time when I was just a little girl. I was in Cleveland. I'll never forget that, or you know. I was born in Cleveland, although we shortly thereafter moved to Stratford on Avon. I'll never forget seeing Noel Coward in a touring company of Dinner at Eight. I will never forget it. And, you know, on and on and on. It has very little to do with what a playwright has or has not said. Is the theater a form of communication, or is it a mystique? Well, I suspect, just like everything else that's ritualistic, it's a mystique. Books are a mystique. Do you know that I had a little funny little thing here happen? I've been a performer for a long time. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a party, and somebody, we were talking about things, and somebody said, well, what have you done? I was telling them all that they'd heard me, my work, and they'd seen that. And I, in casual passing, mentioned that I just did a part in a movie. Immediately their eyes, really? Actually, a movie? Yeah. I could have carried on a drink in the seventh reel and said, the drinks, my lord, and gone off. But the fact that I did a little piece in a movie made me suddenly a very important and a very, very formidable person in this group. Why? Well, they couldn't answer. I asked him, I says, why? You know, this is probably the world's worst movie. Why? Well, it doesn't make any difference. It just doesn't matter. That this is part of the current ritual. So, I remember somebody once saying that everybody has a secret desire to see his neighborhood in a motion picture. And the minute he sees his neighborhood in a motion picture, it becomes a genuine neighborhood. It becomes real. It's been recognized somehow on film. This is a very, very subtle thing. I don't know quite why it is, but you know that this is a very, very prominent part of movie making today. Movies today are making a point of that. They're making a point of going around all over the. In fact, I know one movie that's now in production that is going to utilize that very strange thing, that very point in our psychology. They are shooting parts of the movie in every major city in the United States, in out-of-the-way neighborhoods, not the downtown sections. They're going to out-of-the-way neighborhoods of Chicago, Minneapolis. You never see Minneapolis in the movies, do you? Minneapolis. They're going to places like San Antonio. How often have you seen San Antonio in a movie? They're going to places like Omaha. Can you recall a movie being shot in Omaha? They're going to all these different places shooting this movie, knowing full well that the minute the movie company arrives in Omaha, oh my God, I mean, the excitement, people running around, they're down at the corner of 7th and Vine, they're shooting, and everyone's down there, and all exciting, you know, there's Charlie's pool room in the movie, and they know that all over the country, if they cover enough cities, that the people in that area will all go to see Charlie's pool room in the background with Paul Newman walking past it. Paul Newman was here. They actually was here. Joanne Woodward. They walked right past that very fire plug. And Paul Newman leaned on that very fence right there. Suddenly it becomes real. Absolutely real. And so they are shooting this movie in something like 45 cities in America. And all out-of-the-way places like you never heard of. No one would, like Bismarck. You've never seen Bismarck in a movie, have you? Well, there's going to be Bismarck in this movie. How long has it been since you've seen Redwood City, California in a movie? Well, it's going to be in this movie. how long really has it been since you've seen Andersonville, Indiana? Anderson, Indiana. Anderson, Indiana is one of the locations they're going to shoot. Everybody in Indiana will go. Everybody. And they're making a point in every city to have one or two of the local natives play little extra parts, unspeaking, of course, just walk past. They're not in speaking parts. And so they get the old fat guy that hangs around the pool room. He will walk through the scene where whoever the two stars are, and that gives reality to the people. And they'll love it. Can you see how this movie will go? It'll just have to go, you know. Now, why? Well, nobody quite knows why. Nobody can quite know why. Because they've seen Charlie's Tavern for every day of their life. They have seen this tavern. Why will they pay $2.25 to go in and see it on the screen for like 15 milliseconds? No one knows. But by George, they will. I can tell you they will. It is a fact. This is all part of that ritualistic thing. And don't forget, the best thing on the most exciting thing on television is a commercial. It is true, and I suspect why. I'll tell you one of the reasons I suspect why. For the very same reason that a bottle of Mr. Clean is something you've got in your own kitchen. And the minute Mr. Clean comes on television, that's the first thing that you can truly identify with. The television is peopled by, you know, the beautiful people, the sultry-eyed girls and the square-jawed blonde young men. How many of these people you have in your life, you know? A lot of little fat ladies sitting out there and guys with wrinkles on the top of their heads, you know, sitting out there. They don't, you know, they only look at this sort of blankly. The minute they start talking about Rheingold, Rheingold is what they got in their living. You know, they've got four bottles of Rheingold right there in front of them. This is, it's making contact, just like Charlie's Tavern makes contact in the movie. It really does. And the more commercials you have, the more secure people feel in it, because it's relating to the real things they have and something that they can do something about. They can literally do. You can really buy a new Ford, you know. And you have a Ford, and so on comes the Ford commercial, and suddenly there's a little touch of home there, you know, the Ford commercial. The Ford is riding down the street, and even though you complain about it, you maintain, oh, I don't like the commercials, they have found that your intensity of interest is far greater when the Ford commercial comes on than when this dewy-eyed girl is talking to this blonde youth. Oh, yeah, sure. I bet more of you can sing the Wrigley Gum song, yeah, double your pleasure, double your fun, then you can sing your own high school song. Now, why is this? I mean, why is this? Well, you watch that little guy running back and forth with a spear, you know, right? That thing is very important. It's something that you... And your mouth is full of double mint gum. You're chewing away, and they have made direct contact with you. Absolute direct contact. You know, that they found in England, for example, it really disturbed the English. You know, for years, the English claimed that no commercials, people wouldn't like commercials. Well, when ITV came on, they found that the people in England were far more fascinated by the commercials. They loved the commercials. People would write fan letters and everything else. Of course, it took them for, you know, a while for them to cool off from that kind of ardor. But nevertheless, one of the secret weapons that ITV had to beat the poor old BBC down to its knees was the obvious fact that they came on with a Hillman commercial. They came on, and poor old BBC is there talking about the rare snails to be found on the Wales coast. And all the while, they're sitting there talking about the new Hillman on ITV, and everybody wanted to hear about the new Hillman. They loved it. They had a Hillman in the backyard. You know, they loved the idea of the commercials. I wonder whether or not you would like the baseball games if Ballantyne didn't send them to you. Baseball on Ballantyne, baseball, or Rheingold, Rheingold, all around the town. It's all...
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.